I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Now, last week we had the second ever online MK3D. That's the show that I usually do every month at the BFI South Bank. Obviously, under current circumstances, the BFI South Bank is closed, so the MK3D show has moved online. Now, on the YouTube show, the interviews have obviously had to be edited for length. Here at the Kermode on Film podcast, however, we have full-length extended versions of those interviews. So extended, in fact, that we've split them over two Kermode on Film podcasts. So, coming up this week, we have extended interviews with Jason Isaacs, Monica Dolan and Simon Bird. And next week, it'll be Andy Serkis. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the extended version of these MK3D interviews. And before we hear from Jason, let's hear the trailer for his new movie, Scoob.
Scoob, do you realize where we are?
No.
Look around, man. The clean, modern aesthetic, the cool blue color palette. We're in
IKEA.
The Falcon Fury. Did you say IKEA?
Nope, I said Falcon Fury, just like you.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Shaggy and Scooby were taken?
Yeah. This blue light came down from the sky and beamed them up.
I can't breathe.
I'd have to assume that if they were with their friends, they wouldn't have been kidnapped.
Okay, can you skip the emotional punishment?
What would some guy want with Scooby and Shaggy?
I don't know, but I'd like to shake the hand of whoever created this.
So, Jason, welcome to the show. The last time we were together was the 50th show. It was live. It was at the NFT. You remember that when it was impossible to have a whole huge group of people together?
I know. I think that's the last time I was in any kind of crowd at all. So it seems only 100 years ago.
It does. How have you been? How are you bearing up?
You know, the thing is, anybody complaining about anything at all, if they have a home and enough to eat and aren't sick, is just whining. So I call night about my children not knowing how to load a dishwasher and just a million other things. But the fact is, I'm incredibly lucky and privileged. And my wife is on her hands and knees crawling. You're not coming in here and you're not going in the bathroom. Go away, woman. It's the only time in 32 years she's ever been on her knees.
Can you say hello for me?
See Emma crawling on her knees. Emma,
hey,
go
Emma.
Out the room now.
How you doing?
This is live to all of England. That will never happen again. There will be no kneeling in my marriage. Except me. Get out. And the dog. Now the dog's coming. The whole thing's descended into chaos. Dog, be gone. Go, Missy, go. Did she really think she was going to kneel past the camera and open these doors and go into the bathroom? Anyway, where were we? Have I been, this coronavirus, apart from all the many other things to discuss, likes the Isaacs men. You know, there's a genetic component. So two of my brothers have been very sick in hospital, one for a very long time. My 87-year-old dad was sick, and they're all alive. They all are now carrying consequences they will probably carry for the rest of their life and various different organs. And I'm stunned. I was late for this interview because I was somewhere else and I was driving back. I'm stunned by how people are so reckless and think that that's 2 meters. And people I speak to, even when I'm out in shops, think that it's not such a big deal and they're not going to get it. And if they do, it won't be so serious. I've seen the consequences of it in my family, and I'm amazed by how nonchalant a lot of the public are.
Do you do you have an opinion about, you know, there's currently discussions going on about reopening cinemas and reopening the economy? What's your feeling about all of that?
Well, you know, this whole, would be led by the science, you know. Well, the science is really clear. Don't go near anybody else until we've got some strong therapeutics or a vaccine. The economic consequences are something entirely different, but let's not pretend that going back to school or opening shops and has any science behind it. Nothing has changed. The fact that we're allowed to go and do various things is just because we won't be able to afford to be in lockdown forever. I don't know. I mean, it's up to everybody. I guess it's everybody's individual choice, but I don't know why anybody would go to a cinema until there is something that, if not a vaccine, until there's the knowledge that if you got sick, they could treat you easily and well. I don't know why anybody would ever put themselves in that kind of proximity. Similarly, getting on an airplane, the new airplanes are flying now and people are packed. It's a disease. I thought Emily Maitlis put it rather brilliantly in her opening of Newsnight. This is not a great leveler. People who can afford not to do manual work or not to be in close proximity to others on public transport will get less sick. And so it's no surprise that supermarket workers and people on building sites and those people who, like me, are privileged enough to be able to afford to stay behind closed doors are not as much. I guess we have to open. I'm not in those meetings, but let's not pretend there's science behind it. Our industry, the film industry, is talking about opening not just to the public, but in terms of making new product all the time. There are constant discussions and new protocols. It sounds like a spy novel. The Bulgarian protocols are being discussed much. And very serious people at very, you know, high levels because want to get back to work because the industry is full of people who are working a gig economy and you know, job to job as freelancers. But it involves quarantining the entire hotel and everyone who cleans it and all the caterers and everybody for weeks and then testing every day. With the tests that don't yet exist, which is a test that tells you if you're infectious on the day you become infectious. So all these temperature testing stuff is bullshit because you can be asymptomatic throughout the illness and certainly for the first 2 weeks when you're infectious. Many friends of mine who are talking about film projects in Australia or New Zealand or you know, Scandinavian countries and other places and looking to open up again. And it involves incredibly expensive and elaborate protocols that rely on a kind of honor system for everybody involved that they don't sneak off to see their family or friends. And they seem, to me, insanely impractical, but then I don't have an enormous number of employees and I don't have to generate income for my company. I'm terrified for all of us economically, but of a second wave. I don't know how you feel. I know that you guys are sequestered away somewhere rather rural, which is lovely, but I just don't understand how everyone isn't looking at history and thinking, what can we do differently?
Yeah, I mean, I'm down in the New Forest in Hampshire, and have been here since all this began. And you know, as you said at the very beginning, I have absolutely nothing to complain about at all. You know, I'm able to walk my dog in the New Forest without coming into contact with anybody else. I have friends.
I don't know how you're able to walk your dog because you have two podcasts that I know of. Radio show, you've got a new fantastic telly show that I'm very excited about. We'll ask you questions about. You're clearly writing books, making documentaries. I don't think you've ever been busier. I think you and Jeff Bezos have done best out of coronavirus on the planet.
But you are also aware, Jason, that it doesn't matter what you're doing. When the dog needs walking, the dog needs walking, and nothing else. And of course, you know, I mean, but you know, on a slightly serious note, it is perfectly possible to spend 6-7 weeks. I always describe where I live as Narnia. You know, I mean, this is basically, you know, I am in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and it's very different. And I have friends who are in towns and a couple of friends who are in tower blocks. And it's literally not possible to get out of where they live without risking coming into very close contact with people.
We've got a horribly incompetent government. We've got a bunch of people who would get 3 out of 10 and D's at every exam. It's shocking how poorly they've managed it. But even down to, I think there's a perception issue as well. So parks and sunbathing and, you know, all that stuff, the fuss that the tabloids make about it. No one's getting this disease outdoors. It's very, very, very small percentage. If you look at the data as I do, I'm consuming far too much news like a lot of my friends, you know, day and night, swinging wildly between reading some global expert who says only 25% of us have got it, and the other people say 50% of us have got it. Someone who said, the WHO is saying, there'll never be a vaccine, or not for 5 years, and other people saying, there's never been so many people working on it, it'll be 2 or 3 months before we have therapeutics. So kind of feeling punch drunk with it. But this stuff about people being outdoors is absurd. No one's getting it when they're outdoors and they have a distance. People should be able to go to a beach and a park in the countryside, whatever they like. It's in spaces, it's inside buildings, inside planes, inside supermarkets, inside anywhere that you're likely to get it. So, but you're right, you're one of those people. I have a few friends who live in the countryside and they are embarrassed how blissful that, you know, this time has been for them.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is absolutely true. It makes you recognize, you know, the freedoms that you have. Incidentally, I know you said this at the beginning, but I hope, and it sounds to me like the family members you have who have had it are at least on the road to recovery. Am I right in thinking that?
They are. I mean, I've got lots of friends here, and I don't have lots of friends, it's like some of my few friends when I speak to them around the world who don't know anyone who's got it. And so it feels to them like a very distant disease. And this, in some way, this ties into, you know, back to your subject, which is the screening of stories. I feel like I understand why, but the lack of pictures to go with the scale of the death and the horror of the lonely deaths is what makes people slightly reckless. You know, Vietnam War came to an end. I can't speak English. The Vietnam War came to an end when there were journalists filming the My Lai Massacre and various other things. And we've got shots of empty streets. We've got shots of people clapping for carers and rainbow flags. We don't understand why, in terms of privacy and the horror of it, we don't have footage of people dying alone in corridors and people gasping for breath and wards full of people and the devastation of it. And so it doesn't feel that real to lots of people. They're misreading information about it. You know, it only affects old people, or if you've got diabetes. And I was listening to a wonderful and disturbing podcast the other day from an ER doctor who said that when he needed a break, he went up to ICU. And traditionally, when people are very sick, you send them up to intensive care. And he said, I'm used to going up there. And I go up and I invent these narratives myself. I see old people and I think, well, they've lived their life. They're surrounded by their family. They've had a decent life. You know, we're taking care of them. And the thing that shocked me when I went into ICU was the hair. He said, I'm used to seeing gray hair, and people have brown hair and black hair, and they had no family around them. And those sights were shocking to me. And so I think there's a misconception about how many people of our age, people who are 30, 20 something, and younger people are getting it. They just had a report yesterday that children are just as likely to catch it as adults. They're just not displaying as extreme symptoms, but it means they're just as likely to carry it. So when they go back to school, they'll be bringing it back into our houses. So I don't know. I mean, I recognize the extraordinary privilege of not being desperate for money to buy the next meal. So it's easy for me to say we should stay inside until the science has advanced. But if it's at all possible, we should be very, very wary about easing the other lockdown, I think, including my industry that is desperate to get back to filming.
Well, you are managing to do some work from home. One of the reasons that you're well lit is that you've been doing interviews for tell us about Scoob. And, that's coming.
So I've got ring lights tell us here.
Yeah,
if you
want
to see
happening?
The ring lights?
That's, I do, yeah.
I can see the rings. There, yeah.
Yeah.
So first of all, that explains some of the makeup. So I had to do, I'm in this film, Scoob, which is the new, modern, updated origin story and rather fantastically realized version of Scooby-Doo, the big Warner Brothers movie that in other circumstances I would be, you know, gladding it around the world and doing premieres in different cities and doing junkets. But instead, I'm sat in my bedroom yesterday and did 60 interviews or 100 interviews along with the rest of the cast around the world. My daughters were told to, they sent me a ring light and some of these, well, the fabulous AirPods, and they said, get your daughters to do your makeup. So my 18-year-old Lily did my makeup. She kept on just snotting, not even snorting, snotting with laughter while she's looking at me going, and I went, what? I'd say, love, that's really not making me feel very confident. Then Emma, my wife, came in the room and went, get that off! And I looked like a cross between Danny LaRue and Michael Jackson in Thriller. It was not a good look. She rubbed it all off and put a little bit back on it. She then, now taken to it, she just did my makeup again in 10 seconds. Then she went, it's flaking. Your face is flaking up. It's too late. Just go on. You'll be fine. So this is me. I don't know what she's done to me. But I did interviews for Scoob. And, you know, I'm doing lots, like a lot of acts. I know I'm doing a lot of charity videos, a lot of support for care workers and anything I can. My wife and daughter are volunteering everywhere. I have a, you know, I'm doing my bit. I'm an ambassador for various, you know, I'm doing Red Cross charity and Lumos and Marie Curie and all this stuff. But it's so nice to be able to do not just a bit of work, be able to say, talk about something light and lovely and go, hey, why don't you sit down with your family and watch a film for 2 hours that's just fun and great and nostalgic and not feel like you're selling snake oil. So it was just a blessed relief yesterday not to be thinking about, you know, this, that and the other that's out there.
Okay.
So it's fine. You want me, I mean, I can sell the film. It's Scooby-Doo. Funny enough.
Yeah, go on.
So as you know, I love your show. I'm maybe the number one and longest term listener of the podcast. And anytime I get to people's phone, I subscribe them to you. And when I said, oh, am I to the person who's arranging publicity, I said, am I going on Mark and Simon's show? They went, no, I think their audience skews a bit old. I went, what? What are you talking about? How could it possibly be true that the target audience of Scooby-Doo aren't into 70s prog rock? But for some reason, I won't be coming on that show. So this is my only opportunity. It's a laugh. It's got, you know, I loved watching it. I loved not thinking about what's going on. And I loved just, but there's a bunch of adult jokes in it. I don't mean adult jokes as in, you know, Les Dawson jokes. I just mean there's a bunch of stuff that the kids won't get. There's a bunch of stuff I didn't get because it's for the kids. There's music that's apparently very TikTok savvy. I don't quite know what the hell that means.
I don't know. And it's sweet and funny.
The thing that makes me bitter is that I'm a huge fan of all of the other actors who I never met. Didn't meet them once. You don't meet people when you do animation. And I was looking forward to hanging out with, I met Zach, sorry, Efron. I know Amanda Seyfried from Nine Lives years ago, but the others, like Tracy Morgan, I was looking to hanging out with, and Gina Rodriguez and Mark Wahlberg. Was I looking forward to this? Slightly anxious about meeting Mark Wahlberg, but nonetheless, I would have done that. And I won't be meeting him. And
you and Zac Efron are like besties, because you sent me a video that you made of you and Zac Efron in a lift.
Yeah. I totally press ganged him because you'd been so nice about him. And so
I love Zac Efron. I love Zac Efron. I think Zac Efron's great.
I was backstage with him on Today, which is the giant national morning broadcast show in America, and I went, yeah, Zac, listen. Just look at the video and go, hi, Mark and Simon. Thanks very much. And he went, and he was looking around for security. And he did it anyway, because I don't know if he was intimidated or nice or a combo. And then I met him in the recording studio for Scoob. And I said, oh, Zach, dude, hi. You won't remember me. And he goes, oh, I remember. I said, well, here's the thing. I didn't have time to explain it to you. Mark and Simon have the biggest film podcast in Europe. And Mark is Britain's foremost film critic, and he absolutely adores you. He thinks you're the Renaissance man. You're Gene Kelly. You're Fred Astaire. You can sing. You can dance. You can act. You can do everything. He went, oh, really? And I said, yeah, yeah. And he writes, you know, for the newspapers. And he went, oh. And then I could see him soften in retrospect and wish he'd been more enthusiastic back in the day, the original video. And I was right on the edge of going, do you want to make another video for him now? More of a love letter. And I thought, don't push it. But anyway, now he's fully up to speed. And I'm first in line for the when you open your fan club.
Hey, what's up?
Favorite actor.
How you doing, Mark?
Mark, Zach Mark.
What's up, man? Hey, I just want to say hi and thank you for all the support. I'll see you soon.
There you go. Right. See what I'm saying? That's what happens when you come to America.
That's fantastic. So, oh, I'm doing...
Anyway, I hate selling things. I hate selling things generally.
Go ahead.
And at a time when people are broke and terrified about money, and rightly so, I don't want to be encouraging people to spend money, but, you know, if you're spending money on other stuff, sit down with the family. What's good? I mean, those people who've got little kids in the house, I don't know how they do it. I've got teenagers, and they are self-isolating, as they have been for years, from me and my wife. They're no interest in talking to us, and they're just monstrously embarrassed by our very existence. So we overlap occasionally at dinner. But if you've got little ones in the house, it's so hard. Yours are back. Yours are both home, right?
Yeah, so the family is in the house here in the New Forest, which is really lovely. We had a bit of a sticky moment with my mum, as you may know, but we appear to have come out the other end of that, which is you know.
Fantastic.
Yes, thank you. And yes, so currently my son is professionally employed as a cameraman, because we're making this new TV show here. And of course, nobody's allowed to come into the house or go out of the house.
Yes.
And so they said, well, you know, in order to do it, we need somebody who can work a camera. And it's like, well, he's a teenager. Of course he do. You know, he can work a mixing desk. He can fly he can do anything. So that's it. So now I have this really embarrassing situation of once a week, they drop all the equipment off outside, you know, sterilized. And then my son goes out, gets it, brings it all in, you know, plugs it all, connects it all up. And then
sterilized,
he's on the phone.
So they say.
Sterilized. Yes, there are. So they say, oh, no, we do the whole kind of...
Because I've done a bunch of stuff. I was recording some adverts or whatever, appeals for the Red Cross, and they went, we'll drop the microphones off. It'll all be perfectly sterilized. And I got it. So it came in a kind of Velcro bag with footprints and handprints on it. Well, that's a bit odd. Sterilized. And I opened it, got the microphone out. It's covered in hair.
On the subject
I've got various films lined up, supposedly, to go.
Yes. So what are you doing?
You know, when this switch is flipped... And one of them is in Taiwan, and the director, who lives not far away from me, just before lockdown, called me and said, let's go to Taiwan. I went, what? He said, let's get the family, let's go to Taiwan, we'll rent a house now. And I went, well, I don't know anyone. What are we talking about? He said, it's incredibly safe. They've got full lockdown, full contact tracing. No one's getting sick there. It's going to do way better than Britain. I went, really? Taiwan, but of course it's done incredibly well and much better than Britain, and is really the model, the kind of the poster child for how it should be handled. But I didn't go to Taiwan, and I wonder what's going to happen. There will be no switch flipped. It's a very slow release, and it will be down to. I heard you discussing this on the show and asking Amarasanti and other people about filming, but really it's down to insurance. You can't make a show. You can't make a television show or a film unless the production itself is insured, or you're working for one of the giant studios or the very, you know, deep-pocketed streamers, Netflix and Amazon, Disney Plus and stuff, who are prepared to underwrite the entire show. And if it goes down, they just write it off. And at the moment, no insurance companies will touch any film set. And so none of the unions will allow the actors and the crew members to sign a waiver, saying, I understand I'm entering a possible dangerous area where I'm going to get COVID-19. So there is an impasse until one of those things changes. Actually, after 9/11, because the airlines were uninsurable, government stepped in and temporarily insured the airlines. And I know that people are making entreaties to governments around the world going, will you please insure the film industry? So we'll see what happens.
Okay.
That's apropos of the question you didn't ask.
No, no.
Sound intelligent.
Have you managed to sit with your family and watch anything together other than Scoob, obviously?
This is, you are just pouring salt. It is such an open wound. So I'm aware that in your house, obviously, it's a nonstop film festival.
It really is.
I know. And in many people's houses, I listen to your show and people writing in doing film clubs. And I think it was Asif Kapadia. I can't pronounce his surname now.
Asif Kapadia.
I said, Kapadi, that's what I said. I added an A for no reason. I ripped out the article of The Guardian, stuck it on the fridge, where he talks about how all his family put, you know, films in a hat and pull them out and stuff. My family refused to watch any films of any kind. In fact, they refuse any kind of varied diet. My daughter is mainlining Grey's Anatomy, which is a perfectly good show. And I quite like, you know, a bar of Galaxy. But if I eat 27,000 bars of Galaxy every day after a month, I might just collapse in a puddle of cholesterol. And I cannot take every day. She's watched 5,000 episodes. They've just finished season 16, which, thank the living God, I don't believe in. It means it's now over. And they're going back to season one because my wife didn't start in season one. So that's all there is. If I want to spend any time with my children, I've got to sit down and watch Grey's Anatomy. The other child is watching Outer Banks, which is just consists of a bunch of Abercrombie and Fitch models spouting lines for Netflix. God bless them. And it's the most popular show in the world for people who are right in the middle of the hormonal volcano. But it's not me. I've got in my house, because I want to be a cinephile, but I have a great big gaping abyss where my cinema knowledge should be. I've got Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and Sky's huge catalog and the Criterion collection, plus Biffa and BAFTA and all the DVDs from everything over the years. I've got access basically to every single film ever made or that is currently not out. Plus, as I'm sure you'll be telling all the people who watch any of your shows, all the world's great film festivals combining to put all of their, most of their new product on YouTube from May the 29th to June the 7th, which is an incredible thing. And I cannot get these barbarians, these Philistines that share some of my genes to watch anything other than people who are beautifully lit with perfect blinding white teeth spouting inanities. And it's driving me nuts. I want you to adopt me or ask you to adopt me or anyone.
You are always welcome here whenever physically you could move in. We've got to like, you know, when it's possible and safe to move around, just come and live here because, you know, it would be,
And also I'm trying to, so the other day I threw a little bit of a hissy fit. I said, for Christ's sake, we've got to watch a film occasionally. Can we just watch a film one night? And I suddenly realized, oh, I'm meant to be the father in the household. I'm just, you know, throwing all the toys out the pram. And they were so thrown, they went, I was aware that whatever film I suggested had to be the greatest film of all time that would forever sell them on how much films are better than television and how much better their life would be.
Yeah,
I couldn't decide. I was crushed by the weight of the responsibility of choosing the one film that would serve all these different demographics. And so I couldn't. I gave them a list of 5, 10, 15. And then I looked up your list of best films. One of them likes horror. One of them likes romance. One of them likes, you know, cynical, goth, unemotional things. I couldn't. There was no sweet spot.
So you didn't find one?
I put on Gladiator. The other thing is I've got two...
You went for Gladiator?
No, I've got a 14 and 18-year-old daughter. It was one of the things I had saved, you know, and recorded.
You had the whole history of cinema and you went for Gladiator.
Because my eldest would have been doing her A-levels, is hoping to go to university and do English, is being diligent anyway and making her way through the Shakespeare's, and at the moment is doing the Roman plays. That's the thing I have watched. I have sat down to watch the theatre productions of Coriolanus, Titus Andronicus, give me another Roman play. Oh, Antony and Cleopatra.
Julius Caesar.
Not Julius Caesar yet. And these are some of the finest actors of our day. You know, Tom Hiddleston and Ralph Fiennes and Sophie Coccinello in much garlanded productions. And I know that they're giving enormous pleasure to people all over the world. I can't watch theatre. I can't watch theatre on film. I can't. I want to be there. I'd love to be there in the flesh. And I know it works for lots of people. And I know that when they broadcast them in the cinemas, and please God will again, they're number one box office that week.
Yeah.
I find it excruciating.
Okay, Jason, here is the solution to it. Have you shown them A Matter of Life and Death, the Powell and Pressburger film?
I've not. Okay, no, the thing is, if I suggest it, on principle, just my very existence is an affront to them. If you suggest it, if somebody else who knows them suggests it, if they see somebody on TikTok dancing it, we might get to watch it.
Okay, no, I'm telling you right now, because, I mean, you know, A Matter of Life and Death, and it will work for all ages. And have you seen A Matter of Life and Death, the Powell and Pressburger?
No.
Okay,
no,
fine.
I don't think I have.
Right. Okay, so here's what you do. Whatever thing that is going to be, you sit your whole family down and you watch Powell and Pressburger's A Matter of Life and Death. And I guarantee you, two things will be true.
Okay.
The first is that you will wonder how you lived your life without having seen this film.
I'm so thrilled about this opportunity.
Secondly, your whole family will thank you for it. Your whole family will hug you and love you as the great and wonderful.
You know what? I'm going to cling on to that shred of optimism. First of all, I love the fact that it started with you sit your whole family down.
Yeah.
Nobody in my family, not even my dog, does anything I ask ever. But nonetheless, there might be a bribe or a threat or somehow I'll lock the doors or I'll get them there under false pretenses and maybe super glue the sofa.
Who are you? We should have met yesterday at 0410, mon cher. Unfortunately, I missed you.
Well, you couldn't have missed me because I wasn't here. Now,
I bring you a message from Mr. Trubshaw.
Bob? Bob's dead.
Oh, yes, he's dead. He says, what ho?
Well, that sounds like Trubshaw. But he is dead, isn't he?
En effet. But how? Why?
Cannon shell.
And what should happen to a man who jumps from his aircraft without his parachute?
How do you know?
But it is I who am telling you, my friend. It is I. Your time was up. But they missed you because of your ridiculous English climate. I am French.
But what do you want now?
You, my friend.
What for?
To conduct you.
Where to?
To the training center.
Training for what?
For another world.
You don't mean...
But, my dear friend, that is just what I do mean.
It's going to be interesting watching your TV show, partly just because I like watching you and listening to you talk, because you don't watch that much television. And I am missing films. I am missing films because they have a beginning, middle, and end. Because stories do something to the soul. You know, the fullness of them, the roundness of them, you know, the completion, the catharsis of it. And lots of television, including the television my children are addicted to, is just another week of, you know, mini peaks and troughs, and they're soaps. They're brilliantly done, but they're soaps. And they're not pushing towards anything other than filling your hour. There are some, though, utterly brilliant pieces of television which do what films do, but do them on a much bigger scale and on a richer scale. And I can't wait to see what you discover. What I'm curious about, there's two things I was going to say to you. One is, when I listen to you make your film recommendations, and this is obviously for people watching at home, some of them are for paid subscription services, obviously. There are lots of films on YouTube. My mother-in-law just watched Walter Matthau in A New Leaf the other day on YouTube. But there's Vimeo is a place where a lot of indie filmmakers upload their films. And
particularly short films.
So never hear. Yeah, but the speech is on there as well. And there's some, my agent and everyone's agent in the world, I think, sent them in this lockdown time a long list of very cool indie films that are available on Vimeo. Some of them have passwords in, which aren't available to the public, but many of them don't. Yeah. And it's a place to see those films that don't have distribution, didn't sell to Netflix and Amazon and Disney Plus. And the other thing is, are you going to do only what's coming out now? Or are you making available to yourself on your show where you're recommending to people what they might want to watch at home? Are you curating from everything that's ever been out there?
Which one? Well, yeah, I mean, yes, largely. I mean, I must say instantly, we have to finish in about 3 minutes because your time slot's going to run. But yes, I've done a piece
about... My time slot, just getting warmed up. How dare you?
I've just done a piece about Breaking Bad, which I watched the whole of, and I suddenly realized it was King Lear. I've just done a piece about The Wire, which, you know, I'm 20 years late to it, but hey, finally I got there. I did a piece about Life on Mars. So yes, there is a kind of...
Have you done The West Wing?
I've seen about maybe 20 episodes of West Wing in total, which I realized is nothing other than scratching the surface. But I saw them because Mayo said to me, you have to watch this episode, you have to watch that episode, you have to watch it, you have to watch it. So I'm aware that there is a vast hinterland that I have.
It's the fact that he took the most important, powerful, seemingly highbrow issues of the day, you know, political, of enormous political resonance, and dressed them up or so embedded them in brilliant personal drama that it was the most popular show in the country for a long time. So it just gives a lie to the notion that the public will only accept the lowest common denominator. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And then, Jason, of course, you have to watch The OA. If you love
I know. Garlic, yes.
I know you do.
Yeah.
Special. I know I'm in it, but only peripherally. I think Britt Marling and with her partner Sal Batmanglish did something truly original and brilliant and in a, with a structure and a, themes that you just don't see anywhere else ever. I would recommend it, but, you know, obviously I would.
Of course you would. Jason, listen, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope that when it is appropriate to do so, that we are together in the same physical space.
I can't wait. Thank you for steering us. I will continue to be steered by you. It's just I only get to watch the things you recommend under the duvet. I'm hoping I can rope my family in A Matter of Life and Death will be my only opportunity. So if it doesn't work, I know where you live.
Yeah, no, send them down, watch it, and then send me a text and tell me what they thought. Okay. Here's the thing. Actually, don't take it from me. It's Linda's favourite movie of all time.
She's a far more trustable authority than you, clearly.
Exactly.
And for anyone watching at home, don't listen to any of the idiots in charge. Listen to the scientists. Until they've got something that makes us better, don't go near anyone. That's all. Just stay safe.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thanks to the great Jason Isaacs. Coming up next, I'll be speaking to Simon Bird and Monica Dolan, the director and star, respectively, of the new film Days of the Bagnall Summer. But first, here's a taste of the trailer.
Do you smoke weed? All the goths in my ear smoke weed.
I'm not a goth.
What are you then?
Don't know.
If you actually thought anything mattered, you'd do something about it. But you don't, because there's no point.
I just want to understand.
Well, you wouldn't, so leave it.
I just wanted us to do something fun, but you're right. I should have known you'd just be rude and ungrateful.
Well, it's not my fault you're the most boring person in the world.
We did once used to have quite a nice time together, you know.
What you said earlier about why do we bother? We're still here, aren't we? We can't have mucked things up too badly.
You gonna eat that chicken?
No, I don't eat meat.
You ate the ham it was wrapped in?
Yeah, I eat ham.
Let me start by saying I really like the film. I thought it was terrific, and I watched it with my teenage son, which was a particular experience. Also for me as well, because I was in and when I was younger, and there were all I ever want to say to my mother is I'm really sorry. So just tell us about the origin of the story and where it comes from.
Well, it's an adaptation of a graphic novel by Geoff Windhart that I read probably when it came out, I think in 2012. It just had a real impact on me, and the book sort of stayed with me just because it's so... I mean, the film, as you know, is quite sort of plot light, I think it's fair to say. But the book even more so, you know, it really is a sort of tone piece. There's not much dialogue in it at all. And it's mainly these beautiful drawings. But it just felt very, it's very funny, but quite sad and poignant as well, and really sort of struck the sort of tone that I love. When I sort of started thinking about a film to direct, I made a short and wanted to move on to make a feature. I sort of kept coming back to this wise, slim little book. Then my wife Lisa adapted it brilliantly from the graphic novel and sort of expanded it out to create the whole world.
And when you say it's plot light, just tell a brief synopsis. I mean, it's a couple of sentences. What is the plot?
It's about a teenage boy called Daniel who thinks he's spending the summer holidays with his dad in Florida, but at the last minute his dad cancels that trip. So instead he spends 6 weeks at home with his mum, and they sort of learn a lot about each other and sort of grow as people over the course of that enforced quarantine, lockdown.
Yeah, it's going to seem very relevant to people, I think. Yeah.
So, Monica, you are the mum, and the moment when I was watching, as I said, I was watching it with my son. And there was a moment when my son literally said out loud, "Stop being horrible to your mother."
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about your character and tell me about her relationship with her son.
Well, her name's Sue Bagnall. She's a librarian. She's sort of one of those invisible heroes who I think is, she's sort of the bedrock of relationships that people have, I think, but you know, kind of take for granted. And she's heroic in her way, and I think that she's, I don't know, there's something, I think there's something epic to be found in the ordinary with her. And she's patient, and she's very loving, she's well read, and I think that one of the things that is so pertinent about her spending so much time with Daniel and being forced to spend time with Daniel is that they're both still teenagers in a way. I think it's a coming of age story for both of them, because there's a lot of damage for her that's gone on when she was a teenager, and I don't necessarily think it would surface if she wasn't spending this time with her son. She's having a real struggle with him not being her cherished little boy anymore. And she doesn't understand why he's playing this angry music. There are a lot of changes going on in him that she just doesn't understand. And yeah, I think she came to a bit of a halt emotionally when she was a teenager. So spending time with Daniel is just really fruitful for her in that way, I think.
One of the things that's really lovely about the character is I have this obsession with show don't tell acting. I mean, I love it when you can see what's happened, sitting down and saying to you, well, this is what happened to me. And there are so many lovely moments in the film in which we learn about your character is carrying around the backstory, the ways in which she's been hurt, the ways in which she's disappointed. And I wonder whether, from your point of view, is that to do with, the script is not dialogue heavy, obviously, but do you do a lot of research into, you know, where this character came from, what her backstory is, what her relationship with her sister is? How do you do that as an actor?
Well, I mean, with this particular one, Simon, I was doing a show that I did myself at the Bush, and Simon sent me the script and the graphic novel at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think what's also unusual about this piece is that both of the heroes are kind of introverts. And I don't think that you get that a lot. I think that's really unusual. It could be quite melancholy, but because of the way it's shot and everything, it comes over as quite funny. And just because of the nature of the graphic novel, really, there's just so much inner life in there. Quite early on, it shows Sue listening to the music that she listened to when she was a teenager, because she's sort of befuddled by Daniel's music. So she listened to James Taylor, so I suppose I listened to some James Taylor.
Which is never a hardship, obviously, listening to James Taylor.
I love James Taylor anyway, and I always have. But I think when I'm working, there are two sorts of research you have to do. And one is research into the script, and one is, you know, if there's, I don't know, if your character's a librarian or astrophysicist or something, you look a bit into that and what they care about. With regard to that, I think I'm always careful to let what I mine in the script override what I might find out about those things outside, because if they clash too much with the script, essentially the script's the story that you've been given and that you're working with. So yeah, there's those two kind of researches to do. But I mean, some of the things that you find in a script are so strange. I remember when you know, the tiny nugget gives you so much information. I remember doing Pride and played George Mackay's mother in that, and there was just a little mention about him coming home late on the train. And because I looked at where the train stops were, I found out that he would have been on his own on the train, even though he was with his friend, that his friend got off earlier so that she'd be more worried, you know. So you just find out little things like that, really, that just change the emotional temperature in a really small way. And, you know, you might think, oh, it's not worth looking up, but actually it just makes it quite different for your character.
Just as a very quick sideline to that, gorgeous George Mackay is one of my favourite people in the world. I was just talking to him yesterday for our radio show, and I said to him, you know, I have never, ever heard anyone say anything about you other than how fantastically lovely you are.
Yeah,
and I'd just like to offer you this chance, Molly, to join in the collective who think that gorgeous George Mackay is indeed the loveliest person on earth.
I'll absolutely join in with that. He used to live a few doors down, actually. Used to be my neighbour as well. So, yeah, no, I can definitely join in with that. And he's seen the film, What's Not to Love?
Yeah. No, he is a constant joy. Simon, tell me about that tone, because Monica was saying the thing about it can be a melancholy story, it can be a funny story. I mean, there are loads and loads of laugh out loud moments, not least the moment when our hero finally meets the band, which I thought was just a great... you know, silent comedy moment. But tell us about getting that tone right between the melancholia and the humour.
Well, yeah, I think obviously I personally, because of my acting background, are probably more associated with a broader type of comedy. But that's not necessarily my taste. I think the films that I love to watch and keep coming back to are films that are funny but are suffused with a sort of poignancy as well. I think I was very on top of trying to protect the very delicate, gentle tone that the book has, and not I didn't want to corrupt that in any way. So I think that just in terms of, I mean, a huge part of that was obviously casting, and once Monica was on board, I knew that was a sort of a major step on the way to achieving that, because I think Monica brings sort of just a realness to any sort of any comedy that she's been in, and a sort of sense of humour and a twinkle to a lot of the drama that she's been in. So that was a big thing, but also just in terms of the way I wanted to shoot it as well, about keeping it understated and static, and just giving the characters the space to exist. That sounds pretentious, but I mean that's what a big part of what I like about the book, actually. I mean, in the book, in just the characters that he draws are often quite small in the shot, that felt like an important part of it. As Monica was saying, you know, it's about two people who you wouldn't normally see a film made about, two very ordinary people who are sort of lost in the crowd and very out of place. I mean, one of the things I really like is sort of which you sort of forget after the first page of the book, is that these are two people that are totally unsuited to being to summertime. You know, that Daniel's clad in black at all times, and Sue is dressed in her sort of woolen jumpers. So even in the season they're in, they're outsiders. I've now forgotten what the initial question was.
You've answered it beautifully. I have a memory when I was 16, me and my friend, who were musicians in inverted commas, went to the south of France to busk, and there are pictures of us wearing black jeans, black DMs, heavy black leather jacket. It is boiling hot. Nobody is interested in what we're doing, but we feel like this is the way we dress, and we're not changing it. There's also that lovely thing about whenever you do that, being misinterpreted as a goth and having to explore what you are. But of course, interestingly enough, in the film, he loves heavy metal music. But tell us about the music for the film, some of which I've been playing on the Scala radio show that I do.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. Yeah, so the music is, the score was done on the whole by Ben and Sebastian.
That famous heavy metal man, Ben Sebastian.
Exactly.
Hard rocking. The mosh pits in their gigs are just terrible.
Oh, it's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a weird, sort of a weird choice in a way. but I mean, I sort of experimented with and thought about a lot of different options for that. I guess sort of the obvious thing to do would have been to sort of score Daniel's scenes with heavy metal and James Taylor for Sue's scenes. But I thought it would be a bit...
expensive?
A bit obvious, B, very expensive, prohibitively expensive. and also just a bit sort of jarring, to go be flitting back and forth. Mm. In my head, I wanted the music to do a similar job that the style of the drawing does in the book, that it's sort of a narrative voice. I think as soon as you see the drawings in Joss' book, they're hand done, they're sort of flawed in a beautiful way, they're scratchy, but there's just an undeniable warmth to them as well. And I think that's what Ben and Sebastian bring is warmth. They sort of suffuse the whole film with a gentleness that I was aspiring for. But at the same time, when there was a stage at which it was entirely scored by Ben and Sebastian, and at that stage I felt like we were missing one or two opportunities to get inside Daniel's head. And also just it's sort of sometimes feels like felt like a waste opportunity to not put some heavy metal over some picturesque suburban landscapes. So yeah, so it's sort of 90% Ben Sebastian with the odd burst of death metal.
Monica, I love the fact that whilst Simon was explaining that, you have to hand the graphic. So it seems like it was a constant source of reference. I mean, obviously you knew that we were talking about the film, but the fact that you actually have it to hand.
Still got my post-it notes even.
Oh, wow.
My notes for Simon for our first meeting.
And one of the things that happens during the course of the narrative is that your character is approached in a library by describe for me who Rob Brydon plays and how you would characterise his character.
Well, he actually plays Daniel's history teacher. He seems to sort of hit on all the mums, actually. Or maybe I'm giving too much away, but... So quite early on, Sue's completely bewildered and elated to meet Daniel's history teacher in the library, and he's getting some books out about the American Civil War, which he has to cram for the summer, and he asks her out, and I think at first she doesn't really understand what's happening. She doesn't sort of really understand that he's asking her out, and then she realizes that he is, and then I don't know. It sort of becomes quite big in her head, but they do end up going on a date. But I won't spoil that. I will say just what you were talking about, just what Simon was saying, and really in terms of the wit with which he filmed it. I mean, the way that we performed it, Earl and I. We were very engaged and, very truthful, and it felt very earnest. And then I remember one day, for some reason, just looking through the camera at a shot where they had me on the phone and to Rob Brydon's character and, to his answer phone. And I looked through the lens and just the way it was, the way the frame was set up, it was quite long and it was through the door and she looked quite lonely and she was sort of crossing the door And but it was a really witty shot, and I just thought, oh, that's what I'm in. That's the kind of film that I'm in.
That's what I've signed up for.
And Simon has, you know, just such great taste, actually. And yeah, it just seeing through that lens and seeing what the picture was, it was sort of a lesson in that it's not always the best thing to have an outside eye, I suppose, isn't great for an actor. You know, if you're okay. Self-conscious, it can be a bit of an enemy of being involved. And it was great to see that, to see what world we were in and the wit around what we were doing. And, you know, it created an enormous amount of trust as well. But, you know, our characters were living what they were living, and in an earnest way. And it wasn't up to us to comment on that. It was that's someone else's job. So, yeah.
There's a seemed to me to be a nod to Clockwork Orange, in which we see, you know, the young man sitting at a table doing nothing, whilst you in high speed work around him in the kitchen. And I thought two things when I was watching it. Firstly, I thought it was a really witty way of showing the different speeds of what was happening, the fact that he just doesn't recognise what's going on around him. The other thing I thought was, how many times did you have to take that? Because in real time, you must have been cleaning that kitchen for quite some time.
I think we only did it once, actually.
Good.
Because
good.
The thing was, because there was, I can't remember whether there was music over it or we didn't have to worry about the set. So, you know, Simon and whoever had an idea could sort of say, oh, now empty the bin, now eat a biscuit, now put the washing in the washing machine. So I was just sort of finding things to do. And I always act best with a physical activity anyway. But I do remember kind of thinking,
no offense,
what we're doing.
I feel like it was actually, that scene was much harder for Earl, because you were very active, but Earl had to sit absolutely stock still.
Oh,
he was on his
true.
Phone, but wasn't even allowed to move his thumb. So, yeah, that was fun.
But I didn't really have a sense of how it was being filmed or anything. And, you know, I'm one of those people who thinks, who am I, where am I, and everything. So I think I kept saying, what are we doing? And why am I going there? And it was a bit like, just do it.
Simon, now that, I mean, the film seems to have been very sort of successfully received, is directing your primary interest now rather than performing?
First of all, very generous to say it's been successfully received. I think in general, the audience reaction has been lovely, but, you know, it's yet to sort of receive its... you know, it comes out June the 8th, I think. So we'll see. But fingers crossed.
Sorry, it had its official premiere in my living room with me, son. It's been officially well received.
Oh, okay. Oh,
everything else, everything else is stuff and nonsense. Okay, all that broadsheets, critic. What do they know? It played really well in my front room.
Oh, good. I'm very glad. Thank you.
I want to know at what point your son said, stop being so horrible. What was it that the last straw?
It was when she was up in the loft, and it was a really, really, and, you know, and it was, and it literally said out loud, we're kind of quite strict in our house about you don't talk when films are on, because I'm a complete, you know, I'm a nightmare with that sort of stuff. He literally went, stop being horrible to your mother. Anyway, so Simon, now that it's been so well received, is it largely directing or performing for you?
Oh, I mean, hopefully I won't have to choose. I'd love to continue doing both. If I had to choose, I think I would say directing, because, well, obviously it's incredibly creatively satisfying to take a project from the very beginning all the way through to the very end. I love acting, and I have so much fun doing it. But I continue to have to look for my sort of creative fulfillment in other avenues. And yeah, I think directing is just uh, was was exactly what I hoped it would be, and I'd love to I'd love to do more.
I'm intrigued by that. That it was just yes, what exactly. You hoped it would
what
be.
What does that mean? It was what I hoped it would be. I mean, did you? I mean, if I think of directing, I think of like, you know, Stroheim in Jodhpurs and a, you know, shouting. What did you hope it to be?
I don't know. I guess that I just wanted to feel like whatever the initial sort of instinct or sort of buzz that I got when I read the book, mm-hmm. that I managed to retain that through the entire part of the, you know, for the entire process. And, you know, obviously, as with any job, there are stressful moments. But I felt like I never really got overwhelmed by that, and I could always hold in my head you know, what I was trying to achieve, and I hope that a lot of that is in the finished product. There's obviously definitely, you know, things I'd go back and redo, and because it was my first film, I definitely can pinpoint mistakes that were made. I don't know. Yeah, I think I feel an ownership and an affection for the film that you don't necessarily always get with things that you're just cast in and don't have any sort of emotional attachment to. It's like having a baby. I'm not going to continue having babies, Lisa. You're watching. But
yeah, I'm pretty certain it's not like having a baby. I'm just put that out there. I'm pretty certain having a baby is probably harder.
Oh, all right. Well, the getting into the physical act. Yes, that's
yes.
I don't know why I just can't wait until I'm back.
Because you'll be jet lagged and won't want to come into town, and you'll end up with no shoes to wear to the wedding. You know, what about those?
No.
What's wrong with them?
Horrible.
What's horrible about them?
Everything.
It's just a basic black shoe, isn't it?
Exactly.
I can't get anything right.
You can let me wear my trainers.
You're not wearing your trainers.
Why not? They're black.
Hardly. Tippexed all over with that awful morbid rubbish.
It's not rubbish. It's Metallica.
It's not appropriate for a wedding.
It's poetry. People read poems at weddings. Why don't I get some new trainers then?
You are wearing proper shoes to this wedding.
A wedding of two people I've never even met.
You have met them, actually, Daniel. When you were two, Judith saved you from choking on a grape.
I don't remember.
It was rather frightening, actually. Your face went blue and your eyes sort of bugged out. How about that?
Nope.
Monica, let me ask you, you've been involved in, you know, one of the greatest parodies of life in the BBC, something which anyone who's worked in the BBC has struggled to differentiate from reality. And I think everyone I know who's been, I mean, I've been at the BBC for a while, and I think we've all said it's so close to home. How do you feel about everything that's happening at the moment? I mean, I turn on the thing and I see about BBC Four being, you know, possibly under threat. How do you feel about the BBC and what it's adding to the cultural life of the country?
I think that I've got to say, I think I've never really experienced a time, and I hope that people haven't before experienced a time where we need it so much, because if in terms of our news, in terms of who you can believe, with regard to fake news messages, what to do, what not to do, I'm really glad that we're not in countries that just have sort of subscription news where they kind of shout at you. I think it's you know, the remit right at the beginning, 1936, was to educate, inform and entertain, and somehow that trickles through, and somehow that is what makes it different. And I probably do sound like Tracy, whose super objective is to protect and promote the BBC, but I really hope that we come out of this and that people know that it needs to be protected, and that we need to you know, that it's a great investment for us to keep paying for it, because it, there are lots of criticisms for it being biased in either direction, but my feeling is that it tries not to be. And certainly it's given people a sense of security, I think, in times which, I mean, I've never experienced anything as insecure as this at all. We're really feeling ourselves as hostages to fortune. Maybe we are all the time, but we're really feeling it at the moment. So, yeah, just, I mean, anything really, really familiar at the moment, and anything that you feel that you can trust, I think, best hang on to it. And I just hope everyone realises that.
I mean, is there perhaps a home for him somewhere else in the world of BBC Sport?
OK, Strictly.
No.
What?
It's got to be some kind of sport, Siobhan.
Yes.
OK, so how is that not a sport?
Given the strong reactions provoked by Ryan Chelford's Match of the Day appearance, and given the complex and sensitive issues involved, the problem for the BBC is that they don't know what to do.
What we're looking for is something that isn't literally Match of the Day, but at the same time very much plays to his strengths as, you know, as a presenter.
Brilliant.
Cool. Right.
What strengths?
Well,
he hasn't got any strengths, has he?
OK, Celebrity Big Brother.
No.
It's perfect.
The fact is, that's a Channel 4 show anyway.
Well, it...
Channel 4, yeah.
Yeah, Channel 4.
Channel 4.
Yeah.
Yes, well...
Actually, I think that's Channel 5 now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I think so.
Channel 5, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Channel 5.
Channel 5, yeah.
Yes, we seem to have gone a bit off-piste somehow.
I totally have.
We really...
I mean, you want to be the best duck hunter, you go where the ducks are.
Brilliant. The ducks.
What?
And you take the hoisin sauce with you.
Brilliant.
Fuck's sake.
I mean, this probably wouldn't work.
No.
But I mean, what about something like a question of sport?
All right, okay.
Question of sport?
Well...
No, I'm sorry.
As I say, it's probably not...
Exactly.
Well, no, hang on.
Hallelujah!
So, like, what is that?
It's...
So, I don't even know what that is.
Well, it's one way of burying him forever, for sure.
It's like a quiz show, Siobhan.
Okay.
But it's about sport.
Oh, so what's an actual show?
Yes, it's on every week.
Cool. No, sure, I get this, yeah.
I mean, I think that's really interesting, isn't it?
We love quiz shows.
You mean as a regular team captain? Or...
No.
Well, I don't know.
No, I'm sorry, the fact is there already are two team captains for that show.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, just remind me.
Matt Dawson
and Phil Tufnell.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Yes.
Matt Dawson and Phil Tufnell.
And how are you coping with life in lockdown? I'm aware that we're into the whatever it is that the seventh week, and yesterday I did. I mean, I'm very lucky. I live in the New Forest and I have a dog, so I can go out and walk my dog.
Yeah.
And I'm with my family, which is great. But I was aware yesterday, thinking, you know, I think I might be going a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
How are you coping?
I think it has sort of got to the... I mean, certainly speaking to my friends in the last week or so, I'm noticing... I don't know if it's programmed into us from when we're very young, but 6 or 7 weeks is the end of the summer holidays. And, you know, now something else needs to be happening. I mean, it's actually been really eventful for me, and I've been busier than I've ever been. But also, from a personal point of view, my brother unfortunately passed away on Good Friday night COVID. Thank you. From COVID and pneumonia. So that's something, you know, extreme. And So we're just sort of dealing with all of that, really. It's taken a month to get the death registered just because there's such a backup. And I think a third of deaths registered at the moment where he was registered are from COVID and pneumonia. So, yeah, it's I think I started out thinking, oh, this quarantine's going to be a bit boring and a bit inconvenient, and... But I didn't think it would be life changing. But yeah, I think there's probably a disconnect between people as well. People are experiencing it in very different ways. Some people are grieving. Some people are ill. Some people can't get what they want from Waitrose, and it's more inconvenient. And some people are not busy, and some people are really busy, like homeschooling their kids. And so I think it's I think it's really just in terms of all of us, obviously we're distanced, but I think the experiences are very different. So I think probably the country is experiencing quite a disconnect there, yeah.
Simon, how's it been for you?
Well, I certainly haven't had any sort of, personal loss on that front. I can't complain at all. I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so my days are full on. And yes, once they go to bed, I sort of collapse into a vat of wine. I've had to kick them out of the house for this, because this interview would not have been possible with them in the house. I think my wife's focus is purely on them and keeping them entertained and trying not to rely on just CBeebies 24/7. I'll be glad once the country is able to move on.
And have you managed to get work done? Have you managed to be creative whilst this is all happening?
I mean, I haven't. My wife, when she's not a screenwriter, is a novelist, and I think both of us work in the creative industries, and I think to do that you just require a bit of headspace, and it's sort of impossible to do that in a house with two kids under 5. Sorry, you go on, Molly.
I was just going to say, I think also just from a lot of writers that I know kind of on, you know, and are on Twitter and things, I think there's sort of an underlying anxiety as well, which even though they might have the headspace and time, it makes it a bit more difficult. I mean, I've been really busy, actually. Like, I think you had Mira Sayal on the show, and and she was doing Unprecedented, the digital plays.
Yeah.
So I did one of those as well. Which is kind of crazy, because you're the art department and you've got a DOP who sort of gets you to wander through your house with your laptop and says, oh, it's quite light there, stay there. but, you know, and the director's saying things like, at one point I had to take some pills with a glass of water, and the director's saying, have you got enough water? And I go, yeah, Deborah, I'm fine. And then you realise that she means, is there the same amount of water as was in the take before, you know? And Or the assistant saying, oh, yeah, that wallpaper's really good. Or oh, that phone's great. It's really old-fashioned. And you're thinking, that's actually my phone, and that's my that's my wallpaper. So you're kind of the art department as well. I don't know if Mira experienced that too, but that was quite interesting. And I've done a radio as well in isolation. So that was all set on the phone. And I did the talking heads as well. I did the socially distanced talking heads. So that was filmed on the deep cleaned EastEnders set in a socially distanced way. And it's Alan Bennett. So EastEnders and Alan Bennett, how British can you get? but yeah, I haven't really stopped. And I think we might be doing, I think the W1A guys, we might be doing some little digital stuff, but I don't know yet. So. But yeah, it's been very busy.
That thing about them saying, you know, that's that thing in your house, that's a nice bit of kit, and you think that is actually my house, and whether you can see behind me, this is my office. It's the size of a bookshelf, and it's a broom cupboard, and it's where I work. And Simon Mayer and I have just started doing a TV show from our homes, and they said, well, you know, we want it to be in your living room. Well, I have a family who don't want me in the living room, so I said, no, this is the only space you can have. And they looked at it and they went, why have you dressed it with busts of Elvis? And I went, this isn't dressed, this is where I work. I like
personal
Elvis.
Personal choices.
Yeah, it's exactly. This is not design. This is a lifestyle decision, all right? This is just
this is how simply who I am.
That's well, what's so scary, everyone getting home envy other people, yes.
Yeah, and also I know that it has become a thing that when people see interviews now, you know, there can be somebody talking about something very profound and very profound, and actually what they're doing is they're going, oh, look at that, he's got a copy of
Monica was commenting on all these books behind me, which looks very different from what it is, which is that my wife used to work in publishing and got given a lot of a lot of books, but they're often like the proofs or the draft copies that we can't just take to charity shops because people will be able to track them back. So we're basically stuck with them. So it's more of a storage issue.
I was really intimidated and thought, oh, now I better get one of those virtual backgrounds or something.
The area of your house that we're in looks absolutely spick and span. Mine looks like somebody's broom cupboard, and you, Simon, look like you're living in a library. And it definitely says, "Look, I am really well read,"
which I'm definitely not.
I've got my junk over that side of the laptop, so.
Guys, listen, congratulations on the film. So, when will we be able to see it? When it opens on?
8th of June.
And it'll be available on all platforms, I presume?
I think so, yes.
Okay. And does it bother you at all that cinemas won't be open? Personally, I thought it was actually lovely to watch it at home, but you're happy with that?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's slightly sad, you know, for the people that have worked on it not to be able to go and see it in a cinema. But actually it's, as we discussed, it's sort of quite well suited to a lockdown environment. I mean, it's literally about people whose summer holiday plans are cancelled. I think on that front, it's fine. And it's a small film. It's, you know, deliberately a small, intimate character study. I think part of the way we designed it was it would be nice to give that the full cinematic widescreen treatment and take these very ordinary lives and portray it in an epic way. But we got a premiere. Go on, Monica.
Oh, at the NFT. Well, I was really pleased to experience in the cinema at the Curzon Mayfair, and because it's a big cinema, and you could hear everyone's reaction, and it was so warm. I loved experiencing that, and just the whole audience sort of laughing at once, and but they can laugh in their living room.
Well, there we are. That's the first half of this extended MK3D Kermode on Film podcast. Thanks to my guests, Jason Isaacs, Monica Dolan, and Simon Bird. Coming up next week, an extended interview with the great Andy Serkis. Thanks for listening. And if you're enjoying the podcast, why not visit our Patreon page where there's loads and loads of extras. Stay safe. Remember to subscribe, tell your friends, and keep watching the skies.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.